We need to have, give Randy time to present the article that he read by Harris. Just, and when you read his books, you definitely get the sense that he approves of Buddhism.
Could we take a moment for a round of applause?
What I did was I summarized this article, these books. Anybody want?
That's nice.
I don't think I made enough copies, but
for your own mental health, you should come to management.
Mr. Harris wrote an article for a book called Mindful Politics, edited by Melvin McLeod, and it talks about how the ideas of Buddhism can be used in political situations. And so let's see if we can summarize this a little bit. One could argue that Buddhism is one of the richest sources of ideas to ponder that history has produced. But that is no reason for it to compete with other religions of the world, the spot of the world's truest religion. Point B, many Buddhists would say Buddhism is not a religion. However, most Buddhists practice in very religious ways with lots of superstition and naivete. They do not really talk about the essential teachings of Buddha. So here he begins to differentiate the ideas of Buddha with Buddhism as it is culturally practiced. Mr. Harris feels Buddhism contains as much religious dogmatism, however, as does other religions. He states, quote, there are ideas within Buddhism that are so incredible, and I love this, as so incredible as to render the dogma of the virgin birth plausible, like which is because he acknowledges that the religion that he is particularly endeared with has its complexities and contradictions, too. And another dog, the one dog we talk about specifically, is a particular Guru Rinpoche, was born from a lotus. A person, however, can embrace many of the teachings of Buddha himself without believing in ideas based on insufficient evidence. Mr. Harris feels faith-based religions cannot make this claim. So, one belief that Buddhism has that he is particularly attracted to is called, Buddhist method of inquiry, which, as you can see, is elements of the basic scientific method. One, you state hypothesis after meditating, which is obviously a Buddhist practice. Then one does an experiment by engaging in certain behaviors or avoiding certain behaviors. And then you make observations based on that experiment. And then you come to some conclusions as to whether or not the desired results have been achieved. Namely, in his case, the increased wisdom and well-being of the experimenter. So, in conclusion with that, he sees that Buddhism can be, quote, that Buddhism could be a resource as we, quote, struggle to develop our scientific understanding of human objectivity. Last point I thought was interesting that he made was, if this method of inquiry reveals genuine aspects of emptiness, selfless, and impermanence, they should be talked about just as truths, not Buddhist truths. Obviously, that he feels that if it comes through a scientific inquiry, that the Buddhist that the Buddhists use, that would be important rather than labeling them just Buddhist truths. If Buddhists try to push these ideas as uniquely Buddhist, Mr. Harris feels they will never be accepted by other religions as tools to pursue our understanding of how to transform the human mind from a reservoir of greed and delusion into one of wisdom and compassion. So I thought it was very interesting that it's possible to look at ideas as ideas and subject them to scientific scrutiny. Mm-hmm. He makes a comment in the article that the Dalai Lama apparently has regular conversations with scientists to talk about the world. And that's an acknowledgement that the Buddhists do try to look at things from a rational scientific perspective.
You know about the Dalai Lama coming here to work with a scientist over here in the neuropsychology.
Did he work with Dr. Davidson specifically?
Yeah. A lot of work on meditation and what it does to the brain has been done right here at the university.
He gave a presentation here. The Davidson did.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Talked about very interesting.
His next to last chapter is called Experiments in Consciousness in this book. And he addresses issues, more or less, not in some words, but not,
oh, yes,
not talking so much about Buddhism. But he has a portion that is about meditation. And he points out that it's not enough to look upon these problems with the eyes of a scientist or the methodology of a scientist. You also have to use other methods, which are also used by Buddhists. Meditation is one of those.
Right.
He discusses it's rather esoteric and tricky to understand, but it's worth everybody reading carefully that last chapter, The Experiments in Consciousness.
It's interesting to me that he would look at a religion as a source for his inspiration. I don't know if he's a practicing Buddhist or not, but he could just look at it as a pure scientist and say, well, scientific method is a way to look at the world and get evidence for your beliefs. His criticism is most religious perceptions are not based on evidence at all.
But he also
and
says,
you act on lack of evidence, and he supports the notion to get evidence and then act on that. And I'm not just talking and thinking to myself, it's interesting that he would use a religious framework.
Randy, you indicated earlier, and I agree with you, that Buddhism not being one of the Abrahamic religions seems to be less broadly damaging. Would that also have something to do with the fact that there is a great deal of solipsism in Buddhism? It's so inwardly turned, and there's so little outward action that comes from the Buddhist philosophy or religion, that in itself would prevent this mass murdering that all the other religions have undertaken.
Although I support you, since it's an inward generating religion, it wouldn't necessarily generate violence. But I'm sure you folks have heard of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist, and he looks at the introspection as a way to deal with the world. You are not a Buddhist unless you take your meditation outward and create a community or help the community heal itself, which is an interesting thought.
Well, has that worked historically? I've always wondered about that.
Well, I don't know. You think about the Dalai Lama in Tibet. What has helped the Tibetan people as an entity, as a community, and as individuals?
Well, not much. They still dominated by China.
China's still sitting on Tibetan people like they were when he had to go in exile years ago. So I struggle with that very issue.
Uh-huh.
How has it helped? But it hasn't hurt. The Buddhists don't go out and kill people in the name of Buddhism. They take it on themselves. This is human suffering, they take it on themselves. Mm-hmm. Although, Harrison, I agree with him, the pacifists, if you do that, you're going to get run over. And so you have to develop some kind of, in my framework of thinking about the world, you got to develop some kind of self-defense. And in that, but you do it, and the Buddhists, I think, would agree with me, you do it in as gentle way as possible. Mm-hmm. You don't use the analogy that I've read about, you don't use a chainsaw to cut butter. You use a knife to cut butter. So I think the Buddhist in general would believe that. You need to defend yourself. Or like I think Thich Nhat Hanh would agree with me. You use what you need to do to defend yourself, but you don't destroy to do that. You defend yourself and you move on. And I think that's probably, I hope that was what Mr. Harris is saying, is that you need to defend yourself. And a Buddhist framework would be helpful to do that. But you still have to be careful. You've got to do it a gentle way.
He also talks about
the way that works. It's got to be gentle, but it's got to work too.
He talks about the brain research that's being done, and there's a book that we put up on the Humanist website about this, of that just as linguistics are kind of embedded in our brains, the ability. So ethics is at a certain level embedded. That there is a fundamental that starts emerging at about age 4 of what people perceive as being right and wrong. But then it's moderated by the culture. But he said it also that the harm you do in proximity is more important to the organism than the harm that's done far away. For example, a soldier would not feel right about killing 5 children who were sitting in front of him, but they will drop a bomb on a city that kills many more than 5 children. But because you don't see them, even though it happens, he said, because that genetically moral paradigm is was originally developed when we lived on the on the plains of Africa, we didn't have any way of hurting people beyond our close proximity. And so then he talks about that in terms of that, which I kind of lost him there, in terms of overcoming that idea of proximity versus far away. But somehow I got the feeling that he was going on the side of it's okay to torture people if it would help, the larger group. Because
he believes that?
Well, that's sure the impression I got in the middle.
There's
some stuff in there.
Moral dilemma.
Yeah.
The example he gives is
the train.
Terrorist who is absolutely known to have committed major terrorist acts. I forget what.
The ticking bomb scenario.
Yeah, he's an Islamist terrorist, particular person who has been incarcerated. This is a factual person, I think. And for his role in one of these major terrorist bombings where thousands of innocent people were killed. Islamic extremists.
Actually, anyway. I think what he talks about is the ticking bomb thing where this guy knows where the bomb is going to blow up in
and
New York.
Yeah, he hypothesizes, all right, now we've got this guy, and we know that he is planning to blow up a major explosion, a huge bomb, somewhere in an urban area. And the dilemma we have as his captors is to try to, what do we do? Do we torture him in order to find out? How do we find out where this bomb is and where we find it so we can stop this from happening, because it's going to happen if we just diddle battle and wait for a day or two.
And he says our innate...
Or do we use extreme members, measures, and torture him in hopes that maybe we can find out.
Which sounded way too right-wing to me.
So
but
this is an extreme case.
But what he was talking about is then do we overcome this inbred or embedded genetic concept of not hurting people right in front of him. So he's talking about a moral dilemma.
He argues that it's okay to torture this guy.
I had real trouble with.
But this kind of proximity theory seems to go completely out of whack as a war gets more intense and intense. Just look at the recent case of this guy, these non-coms, who raped this 14-year-old kid and in close proximity killed all of her family.
Right.
Or look at My Lai, or look at these quite a few other incidents that are increasing in the army right now.
Oh yes, you can overcome this. There's no question about it.
Oh yeah, that seems to be totally out of whack these days.
Do you think you really start to develop a moral sense without being taught, without it? I mean, obviously everyone has input, but if you were not tabula rasa, do you think you start developing it, i.e. that it's genetic, or do you think it simply has to do with the fact that somewhere around the time you become forest, though, your world starts getting quite a bit significantly larger, even before you go to school, formal schooling. You're not in the center of your household anymore. You may have developed a brother or sister. Just in general, the world isn't quite as focused, the world you know isn't quite as focused on you as it was when you were an infant, and you're forced to deal with what's a little further away. First with what's just a little bit further away, and then with what's quite a bit further away.
Well, they're doing experiments both with people and primates, and finding that yes, indeed, that they got ways of looking at it, that yes, indeed, it, there is an underlying ethical sense that is built in, and we have to.
We've all read the Lord of
I'm
the
sorry,
Jesus.
But a couple of us have to go because we're going to the opera. So,
right.
So
before you leave, did you want to say anything about this year's bestseller, Letter to a Christian Nation?
Oh, this was because it's focused. It's short, and it's focused on Christianity. I found this easier to deal with. Doesn't have some of the. What I personally struggled with in the middle of the end of faith with Islam and the whole idea of tolerating other people's religion. This one, because it's focused on Christianity, it was a little, it was easier for me to deal with.
So how would it go? It was a Christmas present to some heavy-duty Christian.
It's,
and actually, how would they take it? Is it horribly offensive?
No, I think it's written to be logical. I thought it was
well pick it up with that title.
Yeah, anybody else read this one?
Wasn't this response to all the letters that he got?
Yes. Yeah, all the letters and emails.
Only part of it, and it was quite a while.
Okay. It's a fast read. It's only like 75 pages, little pages.
We have it in the library.
No, but this one can be borrowed. That belongs to us.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes. Yeah, anybody wants to borrow either one of these?
Barb, Barb,
I'm struggling with two very contradictory things that have gone through my mind here as we've been talking. And neither of them have a resolution in my mind. One is the comment about Harris on pacifism, and I'm thinking of Thich Nhat Hanh, who wouldn't be known to the United States if it weren't for the sponsorship of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a Christian pacifist organization who really funded his travels.
Was published by Shamwell Press, which is not part of the Fellowship of Reconciliation.
I know, but long before he was discovered here.
Initially he was sponsored.
He was sponsored and brought to the United States by the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which as a pacifist organization spends a lot of its time trying to deal with how do we find common ground amongst all of the fundamentalist organizations and points of view. So a dilemma there, because perhaps there are examples of Christian organizations, although not a fellowship is not strictly Christian, but it's based on it. The second is that the earlier comments having to do with martyrdom and the Christians who had converted in Afghanistan being brought out, one of my second cousin's job is as the news director for the Voice of the Martyrs, an absolute right-wing fundamentalist radio outfit, internet-based, based in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. But hearing the comments about Harris's comments about the difficulty, I have to ask myself, well, maybe they are doing the right thing to object to the fundamentalists. Who are the Muslims. Now, on the other hand, I can't quite bring myself to be happy at family reunions when I'm told that these are the prayers that have to occur at meals, and every day we have Vespers, and well, they have, and so on. But here's a group that I have absolutely no respect for. But in effect, they're doing exactly what Harris says, and that's standing up to religious extremism, which is supposedly blocking freedom of expression. And so, just a dilemma in my mind.
Yeah, I think it's a follow-up to that, Al. I think one of the things that bothers me is, particularly with the increasing strength and growth in a lot of the fundamentalist church, I mean, if you look at some of these West Side churches that have 10, 15,000 members, is that I think we really need to be concerned about our young people, because what I have this feeling that there's an underlying growing intolerance of other people and other thoughts and other ideas and other cultures. And I think that growing intolerance is because there's such a strict set of, here's what you are supposed to believe, here is what's right, here is what's wrong, and the young people aren't developing, you know, their own philosophy, they're not developing their own thoughts and opinions. And what they do is, if they get into a situation where they're facing issues of, you know, diversity or anything else, they can go into that and shut off, shut down. I'm right, they're wrong, therefore I don't have to care about them. And I think that this is going into our young people all the way through, in colleges, our young people going into military. And I think it's an underlying thing, like there's only one right thing, there's only one way to think, that everybody else is wrong. Therefore, you don't really have to care about them as much because they're wrong. You don't have to try to get to know them or tolerate them or accept them. And I think that's in the homophobia, and I think that's in... it seems to me that some of the increasing violence and the troubles that we're seeing in our school systems are based on kids who just are floundering. They don't have any moral, philosophical base to lead their life with.
That's right.
And if they do start questioning, then they get really lost, and these are probably the kids that do bad things and commit suicide and all, because they haven't got, and society's not offering them this either. And I think it's, I'm really concerned about our young people right now, and our young people are now becoming teachers of the next generation of children. They're becoming our leaders, and I think a lot of them really don't have a clue as to where they belong in the big picture of the world.
Well, Kathy, to make sure that I wasn't, by saying that there are thoughts and dilemmas about the Voice of the Martyrs, I've looked at their website. They make the Family Research Council look like flaming liberals.
Yeah.
they are really bad news.
Maria?
From what you were saying, it made me think of, two things. One, going back to the ticking time bomb theory and the torture thing. I mean, I think that they've shown scientifically that it's not effective to torture people. You don't even get it. Even if you don't get it, it doesn't work. And secondly, what you're talking about is pretty much critical thinking, and which schools say they want to teach, but every teacher says, there's no way. That's the one thing that we're the last to ever get to, because we have all this doodah stuff that we need to do.
Well, I wanted to say something about what my mom was saying about how people are starting to teach the younger generation. And I'm in a class now, which is called the advisory team, and we teach freshmen things, and we're now in this unit about culture and people who have disabilities. And certain days are spent on teaching things. So we teach them, the other day we taught them about Tourette's, and we watched a video. And we didn't have time to have discussion. So we're discussing it on Monday. And we have that whole weekend for them to think, and I guarantee you, we'll go back and we'll say, well, what did you think about the video?
They won't remember it.
Dead silence.
Yeah.
No opinions. Yeah. No opinions on what they think. They don't want to express their opinions. And we've had this huge problem with all of the advisory classes, because they don't want to twist their opinion, and they have nothing to base it on, nothing.
Why are they afraid of being criticized for their opinions, or did they just not even go that deep?
I think they just don't have any, they have nothing to base it on, they have no thoughts about it.
I don't think that we offer from a very young age areas in which you can learn to analytic
right.
tools
right.
to analyze
exactly.
things,
exactly.
And we're just teaching for the tests now.
Right.
And we're
right.
not in
there. Right.
I taught you.
Rose had something to say.
Yeah, I'm trying to get my thing.
Sorry.
Well, I'm going to tell you two experiences.
Okay.
one, Rosemary left, so she can't hear this, but when our children were small, we didn't have television sets. And my mother took care of them sometime when I was working. And there was a movie being shown on the telly, Bombs Over Tokyo. Have you ever seen that?
Van Johnson.
Hmm?
Van Johnson. Yeah.
But anyway,
this was
so.
Late 50s.
Yeah, so our two boys are watching. Damon was maybe 3 1/2, and Peter, 5 or so.
He's 2 1/2 years older.
And just to show the difference in these two personalities, Peter is gung ho over this, the planes going and everything. And Damon, who's always been very quiet, very thoughtful, he said, and my mother told us what happened. He said, "Those bombs are falling on mommies and children." Mm-hmm. That's mind blowing from a 3 1/2-year-old.
Okay.
And Peter just didn't get it. Peter was the sort of kid who, you know, was go, go, let go every minute, and not until he was flat on his back in bed did he start to think about things. Never mind. But then the second story is a true story about what happened to Peter when he was in high school, and he was, this is in
Whitewater. 70s.
Yeah. And he was maybe a freshman or a sophomore in high school. And he was growing his hair long. Peter has big ears, like his dad. And when long hair came in, that was very nice camouflage, you know? But also it was the in thing for certain hippie type kids. But the school did not approve of long hair. And so one day Peter came home with a big bump on his head. The senior had, in the lunchroom, which was right near the principal's office, had pushed him against the wall and beaten him up. So we demanded a conference with the principal about this. We talked with the assistant. And he had the boys' parents and us in the room together to talk about this episode. And the boy's mother said, "Now if he just cut his hair, everything would be okay." And she was concerned that her son, you know, this is Vietnam days, and he was going to go into the army and so on. And I thought to myself, yes, and then he's going to beat up everybody who doesn't look like him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, tell him what the principal said.
What did he say?
He said, "We expect the other kids to enforce our
Oh, that's our right, to take care of us.
Oh.
Right. Okay, now fast forward.
He told us in that meeting a while ago.
Fast forward, maybe 5 years later, there's a murder in town. This boy had been to Vietnam. He was married to the daughter of one of the other store owners in town. His parents owned a store in town. They had 3 children, and he was obviously a violent person, and she told him that she wanted to divorce him. He killed her and then killed himself. And it was a terrible tragedy, but this is what bullies are capable of. And the mother, who had defended her son's behavior, was now suffering the consequences of having to raise her 3 grandchildren because their parents were gone.
The same kid?
Pardon?
Same kid? Or
same
was it the same kid?
Yes.
The boy who was bullied, right, okay. Peter.
That's what I thought.
Had been to Vietnam and came back, and he was still violent, and he couldn't bear the idea that his wife was not going to take it anymore, and that's what he decided to do. Those are two examples.
I bet it's more than just that his wife wouldn't take it. I bet he also, he probably knew he had a problem, and he was probably also terribly afraid of being alone. And
I'm sure he is.
You know, and that, oh, she wouldn't take it, so nobody else would either, so let's just get this whole thing over.
He was obviously a very disturbed young man. What that was, it's complex, I'm sure, but we'll never know.
Is there any wisdom in this book about our direction, about what we should do with the Middle East situation? And all these people who want to kill all infidels?
While you're looking up
that. He does discuss this a little bit, but I think he does go that route in detail.
I have a DVD called The God Who Wasn't There, which has an interview with Sam Harris. In fact, the special features has 13 minutes of interview excerpts, and the interviewer at one point asks him on this question of the Islamic conflict, are we doomed?
Right.
And he says, I'm not sure.
He talks that way here.
I'm just starting to read this book by Geraldine Brooks, who was a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. This is her first book, Nine Parts of Desire, and she's talking about women in the Islamic world. And she she's talking about one woman in particular whom she had known early in her days and was very modern. She was from Egypt, very, you know, wore makeup, dressed as Westerners did, and so on. And then all of a sudden, she just changed completely over to wearing a chador, to doing the whole Islamic woman bit. And she talks about her a little bit in this, and it's really scary. And in one section, she's talking about the American embassy at the time of the hostages. And she said she apparently had been a translator. This woman had been a translator. And Geraldine asks for comments on her excellent English, and she says she had perfected it during her time in the nest. Excuse me? In the nest of spies, the American embassy, she said. Hamada had been part of the black-veiled horde that occupied the embassy and held its personnel captive for 444 days. Her job had been to translate the hostages' mail. I asked her if she'd ever felt sympathy for them. Sometimes, she said, when she read the letters from American school children. But I knew they were spies who had tried to ruin this country. I was disappointed when we released them. Personally, I thought they should be executed. That's one view. And then back to this woman who changed from being a very westernized Islamic woman to being a revolutionary. And they're having a little chat, she said. And she's talking about with this woman about all kinds of things like Persian poetry. She's Iranian. It was easy to begin to see her as another smart woman my own age with whom I had a lot in common. Then she would run a hand through her bobbed chestnut hair and deliver an opinion devastating in its extremism. Israel has to be obliterated, she would say, reaching for her teacup and taking a delicate sip. How do you get food? She said, I'm looking forward to taking part in the war for its destruction.
How do you talk with people like that?
Okay. You know, Sam Harris discusses that, so I wrote this conflict in Israel. But he also blames Jews.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're, you know, their part in believing that Jerusalem was their homeland and they have the right because it was ordained by their God. And at the same time, the Muslims claim that it's their land because it was ordained by their God. And so there's a hopeless situation.
I think Jerusalem should be...
They're both convinced that's the view that's been... I have no hope whatsoever in the long run of Jerusalem because of that.
I think it should be neutral ground.
There's enough of the people in both of those faiths, both Jews and Muslims.
What?
I'm going to make a comment based on this article he was talking about with the first evidence then faith. It seems to me a lot of problems. First of all, in America and other places, there's this idea that you cannot criticize religion. Mm. And that's got to be broken up. She had enough trouble compared to the Muslims and the non-Muslims in Muslim countries. It's rather interesting. I mean, they could get killed if they start criticizing the religion. And second of all, there seems to be sort of like a relativism going on. I read this beautiful book, The Republican War on Science. I don't know if anybody else has read it.
The Republican War
on Science.
And he talks, among other things, about a new act called the Data Quality Act, which basically lets any politician, if he doesn't want to pass something, to just throw it back in the bundle and say you have to have more evidence. No matter how much evidence or whatever they have, they can just throw it back if they don't want to do it and wait for more evidence.
Really good evidence, examples of that.
Whereas the latest
peer, you know, peer, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Whereas, you know, if they like the thing, or, you know, they can, you know, just have like a nothing much, and they could just take this one study that agrees with them, and if there's 50 million studies that don't agree with them, they can take this one study that agrees with something they want to pass and say, whoa, look at this, this is the data quality that we want, and pass the thing whether or not it makes sense whatsoever or not. Let's see, what was the point I was going to? Well, with this evidence versus faith, if more people sort of got more of the evidence first than the faith, you know, I mean, one of the problems with going with the Bible is you can interpret it to mean practically anything you bloody well want.
Of course.
And people do. So, you know, if they have some regular evidence and then go into doing the faith, that's another question.
The Bush administration and all of its agencies is dumbing down the scientific policy.
Inaccurate. They're not just dumbing down. They are just taking
They're changing.
But what you just said is, brings back, Susan, when I immigrated into this country and when I finally had the chance to go back to college and finish my first American degree, I took a speech class because I was always afraid to speak in public, which people don't believe me now, but I did. I really had a problem. And had a wonderful speech teacher, and one of the first principles people discussed was this cultural phenomenon to me that you don't discuss or argue about religion and politics. So my first seminar paper in that course was why you should discuss religion and politics. I went on this way and got an A in the course and started on the way of opening up. But that's nothing new, really. That's a deep-seated American cultural habit or custom, as far as I can see.
My mother taught me that's the only thing worth talking about.
Exactly. That's what my mother was, too.
Well, people are wrong with the religion. They particularly, when they can't defend themselves, they really can't. Mm-hmm. And people who look at things rationally, when you really put them on the spot, they cannot rationally argue with you. That's why they won't, because most of them have not transcended this type of thinking, and they really can't. That's why they don't want to discuss it.
Well, and they haven't learned to discuss it without beating the other people over the head. And because there is an art to that, too, an art to debate and discussion. But that's not taught.
Anyway, it's not distinctively American. So if you go back to the Royal Society of London in the 17th century, they had rules.
Same thing?
Don't discuss religion or politics.
Oh, really? Oh,
because it doesn't get you anywhere. And they were inventing modern science. Collect evidence.
21st century Britain, you can get a hell of a lot of arguments about religion.
You know, sometimes being around people who are being a good example for people who are not educated. Because I have around a lot of people who I don't think they're dumb. They just don't have expanded consciousness. They haven't had the type of experiences to make them seek a higher consciousness.
Right.
If you set a good example for them, like I do for my nurses who are all Christians, and my nurse who's young and has a family, she's not a Christian. She's a Catholic girl. She's just a middle road person. She always says, "How do you know so much?" And I just like fall over. I'm like, well, you know, it's called knowledge and in-depth reason. I mean, she's seen me question specialist diagnoses and be right. I'm like, I question everything. It's your job to question everything. It's not your job to go along with what other people do. Because she's seen me question specialist diagnoses and be right. Because I question everything. And they don't. So sometimes I just want to shake them all up and say, you people need to start thinking. But instead, what I've done for people in my office is try to set a good example. Although it's been really hard because I'm just so mad at all of them. I want to say, you're all responsible for what's going on in this country. And regarding Israel, I actually think when I've watched, you know, people like me who just want to, who agree with Sam Harris, you need to get in everyone's face right now and scream at them. In a certain sense, I believe that, but I also believe, just like with Israel, has a huge peace movement, a huge middle-of-the-road movement, and I believe this country and Israel and everything, if we're going to be saved, it's going to be by the middle-of-the-road people have to speak up. Like in the last election, Americans spoke. You know, unfortunately, like, the bigots came out in mass amounts to vote for the marriage amendment. But in general, the last election was Americans realizing they have to take a stand against extremism, but they didn't realize how forceful these people are to take their country over. And the same thing with Israel. Hopefully the middle road of Israel will speak up and put an end to the fighting. And I think it was Sharon who was really criticized recently by the middle of the road when he wanted to back out of the West Bank. The extremists shout the loudest, so the middle has to take over. So if middle America wakes up, but it has to be them. It's just like the Republican Party has to be saved by the moderates. Democrats can't do it.
But you know, there's one other thing.
Let Kathy just say something. She hasn't spoken.
Oh, I'm sorry.